If you like Area 45, you're going to enjoy the Hoover Institution's other podcasts, Uncommon Knowledge, The Classicist with Victor Davis Hanson, and The Libertarian with Richard Epstein. Subscribe now to the Hoover Podcast at hoover.org/podcasts. That's hoover.org/podcasts. Hoover Podcast, ideas defining a free society.
Hello, it's Thursday, May the 14th, and welcome back to Area 45, a Hoover Institution podcast examining the policy avenues available to the 45th President of the United States. I'm Bill Whalen, a research fellow here at the Hoover Institution, as well as a Virginia Hobbs Carpenter Fellow in Journalism. My guest today coming to me from the East Coast, what normally would be Hoover's Washington, D.C. office, but he is now in quarantine in Northern Virginia, I do believe, is my colleague Daniel Heil. Daniel Heil, Danny Heil to his friends, is a Hoover Research Fellow. His focus is the federal budget, tax policy, and federal anti-poverty programs. He's written on the perils of telecommunications regulations, the economic effects of e-business. Danny Heil served as Governor Jeb Bush's economic policy advisor during the 2016 presidential campaign, counseling him on the federal budget, tax policy, and the federal anti-poverty programs. Danny received a master's of public policy degree from with a specialization in economics and American politics from Pepperdine University. One thing about my friend Danny is his blood may be red, but it actually is also Dodger blue. And he is sitting here like me wondering if there's going to be a baseball system. My question to you, Danny, if the Dodgers do play, if they do to win the World Series, would you agree it is tainted goods at best?
Oh, absolutely not. If any other team wins it, of course, there'd be a big asterisk. But if the Dodgers win, it was through their massive acquisition of talent.
This is what I love about the average baseball fan. They hate the systems being talked about, this abbreviated 82-game schedule. They think it's kind of just sort of illegitimate. But hey, if their team goes far, we love it.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, so last time you and I talked, Danny, which was in person, which was in the D.C. office, we talked about your America Off Balance project, the purpose of which was to raise awareness regarding budget inaction and to showcase reform needed to avoid a financial catastrophe. And I wonder, Danny, who on Capitol Hill listened, because what we've seen in the past couple months is Congress has approved not one but four different packages of economic, I guess, emergency, what would we call it, relief funding? What would you call it, Danny, what they're doing with regards to COVID? Is it relief funding? Is it an emergency package? Is it a supplement support?
It's a little bit of everything, right? It's the shotgun approach to relief, stimulus, you name it.
Right. So let me quickly go through the packages, and I'm going to get your thoughts on where this is taking us. So first thing, Trump signs, it's on March the 6th, I believe, Danny. It's $8 billion for health agencies, testing, small business loan subsidies. That's it, $8 billion. The second package, Danny, March the 18th, we're now up to $100 billion. And it's $100 billion in tax credits for employers offering paid sick leave, plus increases to unemployment benefits, food assistance. We then go to March 27th, Danny. $2 trillion with the T, $2 trillion, including checks to households, bailouts for airlines, other distressed industries, plus loans and grants for small businesses. A fourth signing, Danny, on April the 24th, $484 billion, an additional $321 billion of which is for the Paycheck Protection Program, $75 billion for hospitals, Danny, another $60 billion in small business disaster loans and grants. And now we go to the fifth possible package, which the House is going to vote on tomorrow, Friday the 15th, I believe. This would be not one, not two, but $3 trillion in new spending, about a half a billion dollars for state governments, about another $375 billion for local governments, $40 billion for Indian tribes and territorial governments to offset cuts to services and laying off public workers. And there's more, and I'm not going to spend the whole broadcast here explaining what all's in it, but there's a $200 billion Heroes Fund that provides, quote, hazard pay supplements to first responders, healthcare workers, $175 billion for states, Danny, to pass along to homeowners and renters, $100 billion for states, universities, and school districts. The $600 weekly unemployment supplement that's supposed to expire at the end of July would be extended through January of 2021. And it would also produce a new round of checks, $1,200 for adults, making up to $75,000. Your kid's check, which was $500, would go up to $1,200. Households would get as much as $6,000 per house. My crude math tells me, Danny, that the first four packages add up to $2.6 trillion. That fifth one would more than double that. Tell me, what are the long-term and short-term consequences of what this is going to do to the federal budget?
Yeah, so leaving aside the House plan on Friday, the ones that have been enacted, you're looking at just this year alone adding somewhere in the range of $2 trillion to the federal deficit just this year alone. Now, beginning in this year, we were projecting deficits of $1 trillion, so that gets us up to $3 trillion. And then add in the economic effects of the shutdown, and you're probably looking at deficits up to $3.7 trillion. So these massive numbers are truly astounding, hard to even get your mind wrapped around it. And then, as you said, you know, if we turn to future legislation, you know, that it's very unlikely that these reforms stop or these plans stop here. And you know, certainly the Dems plan on Friday is one effort that likely won't pass. But there's certainly going to be further efforts, particularly once we open up and we figure out what the economic damages are of further stimulus. So when all is said and done, you're looking at in the near term, deficits exceeding 20% of GDP this year and likely exceeding 10 to 15% next year, even under the best forecasts. And over the long term, of course, you know, that adds up to the federal debt. We're likely to exceed 100% of GDP this year in the federal debt. We were at about 80% going into this year. And just to show you how far that moves us, previous projections had us crossing that 100% mark probably somewhere in early 2030s. And now we're crossing it in 2020. So if you were concerned about the debt and the long-term question marks, you know, we should be really concerned about it now because we've essentially moved up the forecast by 10 years across the board.
Okay, so explain the problem here with racking up debt versus GDP. You say that it's 100% of GDP. That rolls off of most people's backs, though. They don't understand either what GDP is or they just don't understand the connection between the two. But what is the significance of racking up this kind of debt?
Yeah, long term, when you're asking about it, you have two sort of question marks. One is just the effect on government borrowing on private investment. The Congressional Budget Office, sort of the arm of Congress that scores legislation and makes economic estimates over the long term, they estimate that every dollar of deficit increases reduce private investment by about 33 cents on the dollar over the long term. So what you're really looking at is a reduction in private investment. And so that means less economic activity, lower productivity, lower wages in the long run. And then, of course, there's a larger concern over reaching some tipping point in which you end up with some sort of debt spiral where interest rates start to rise. Those interest rates have to be, we have to borrow more money, driving up interest rates further. And you could end up with a situation where the debt really gets under out of control and you end up where Congress has to immediately enact, you know, really draconian spending cuts and large tax increases. But even if that doesn't happen, you still have this drag on the long-term economy just through the fact of increased deficits every year, as far as the eye can see.
Let's continue the budget for dummies here for a minute, Danny, and I'll play the dummy on this, a role I play very well sometimes. But let's, what is the, when you have debt like this stacked up, how does the government pay it off?
Well, it's combination of, the question is, do they pay it off? You know, they roll it over into new debt. That's been sort of what we've been doing for a long time now. And then long term, if they discover that it's harder and harder to lend money or to borrow money at reasonable rates of interest, the other alternative is higher taxes or spending cuts. But those are the three options.
Right. But obviously, we're not at the point where anybody's talking about spending cuts. Speaking of which, there is a budget in theory due in October, right?
Yes. And it's going to be an open question to see what Congress exactly does. We've seen last year where we had the shutdown, where Congress couldn't agree. Certainly, Congress is staying out of Washington for the foreseeable future. So, you know, it's on open question marks. But my guess would be come October 1, we're going to get a continuing resolution, just like we've seen in the last few years.
And the continuing resolution, it just says the budget is funded for the certain programs for X amount of time, right?
And yeah, so when we're talking about what the annual budget process actually looks like, it's about the money going to what they call discretionary programs. And this is programs that require annual appropriations by Congress. And fiscal year starts October 1 of every year. They're supposed to have a budget before that date that specifies how much each government agency is permitted to spend. And years past, they haven't been able to meet that deadline. So typically what they do is they pass a CR, a continuing resolution, that says spending can continue at the same rate that it was in the previous fiscal year. But ultimately, it gets to a larger point here that Congress doing things like that, it really just shows you how far away we are from the right way to budget. And the right way to budget is to think about priorities and what is the federal government, what should the federal government be spending money on? And for too long now, we've sort of been on autopilot on just spend more on the things we're spending already on. Don't even look at half the budget. Those are the mandatory programs of Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid. But even the part they do look at, it's often just a automatic increase of we're going to grow it by inflation or we're going to grow it by a little more than inflation. So there's not a whole lot of effort being made to set priorities. And I think when you look at the current crisis and the pandemic, it's pretty clear that we've had mixed priorities and poor priorities that have focused too much on sending checks and transfer payments and not enough on planning for future crises. And we're seeing the results of that now.
Right. So over a 7-week period, Danny, the federal government racked up about $2.6 trillion in spending. That's, I guess, at the age of binge watching, that would be binge spending. But is there any precedent in American history to go along with this? I guess we would look at spending during World War II, perhaps, or maybe spending during the Great Recession. But does anything approach $2.6 trillion in less than 2 months?
Outside of World War II, where you can probably make some estimates that would show, rapid increases in spending once you adjust for inflation and the size of the economy. But beyond that, and peace times, this is historic. But I would say that, when we probably getting ahead of myself here, but when we look at long term, if you just look over the next 5-6 years or so, the growth in Social Security and Medicare alone, we're going to be about the same size of the spending increases this year, of about $1 trillion is how much spending is rising just from that CARES Act, the big one that you mentioned, the third act. And so in just a matter of about 5 years or so, Social Security, Medicare is going to grow by that amount. So it's unprecedented in the past. But going forward, these were sort of what we were projecting over a pretty quick time period of these kind of spending growths.
Right. Let's talk about that for a second. If you were to draw a circle for me and start cutting up the federal budget into pie, can you explain to the listener what that pie would look like?
Yeah, so about 2/3 of the budget goes to mandatory programs. These are programs that aren't subject to the annual appropriation process that Congress does for the discretionary programs. Though that 2/3 is mainly going to two programs, Social Security and Medicare, and then Medicaid is a distant third. And those two programs, Social Security and Medicare, are also the ones that will be growing much more quickly than the rest of the budget. And then that other third is split between interest and discretionary programs, mainly defense. Defense is about half of discretionary, and then non-defense programs funding everything from the FBI to the State Department to all of the activities we think of when we think of what government is supposed to be doing. That's being funded by about 15% or so of the budget goes to fund those things, and then another 15% goes to defense.
Okay, so if you wanted to start cutting the budget, where could you butt? Where could you cut? Where would you butt? Where politically could you get it?
Politically nowhere, right? We've seen over the last few years, and clearly now, and I don't think anyone, even the person that's most aggressive for austerity measures would really be looking at making cuts now. The question is, where would these programs be headed to in the future? And it's unambiguous that in the future, Social Security and Medicare, where most of the money will be spent on. And as we come out of the crisis and as we enter the recovery period, certainly the hope needs to be that policymakers will be making some long-term substantive reforms to these programs. And in reality, it's not about necessarily cutting these programs. I think it's about reforming these programs in ways that produce more sustainable growth rate for them. And I know when we spoke last, my sort of policy reforms haven't changed. It's the same answer. The only difference now is we're at about 20% of GDP higher in debt. And if you were at all concerned about debt before, you should be that much more concerned now. And it means that 3-4 years from now, when the recovery is in full swing, we should, and hopefully sooner than that, we should be eagerly looking at ways to reform these large entitlement programs.
Right. Let's talk about Congress for a second, Danny. I worry that there are members who fall into one of three categories when it comes to spending and deficits. They're either A, members without a clue who just don't understand that we're on this collision course. There are B, members without a conscience. They may understand that this is some level, but they live in the now and they certainly live to get reelected, so they're going to spend. And then category C, Danny, which would be members without courage. And maybe they all look at the lesson of Paul Ryan, former speaker, who, of course, was famously interested in all sorts of entitlement reform, and were to get Speaker Ryan nothing but grief. So I just wonder, as you talk about debts and deficit to Congress, are there any champions on Capitol Hill right now with this cause, or is just the whole place just COVID frenzy for the time being.
Certainly for the time being, but I think if you back up to January and you look through the halls, it's pretty scarce. Who was really concerned about this? You would say guys like Justin Amash, who's not going to be there for much longer. He was certainly talking about it, but outside of that, there was this general sense of, well, this is a problem, but it's a problem for tomorrow. And it's really unfortunate because you look back to January, you look back to last year, there were good economic times. Unemployment was at a near all-time low, and yet we were running close to $1 trillion deficits and now and forever. And so it's certainly a question of what is the impetus that moves people. And we hope it doesn't take some sort of, debt crisis where you end up with a massive increase in debt that's not sustained and that's just continuing to rise because of increases in interest rates or whatever. But short of that, the hope is that when Social Security and Medicare, these two programs have trust funds linked to them, and those trust funds are quickly being depleted. We're spending far more on Social Security now than we're receiving in Social Security payroll taxes. And that's going to continue for the foreseeable future. And with this crisis, the date at which we run out of money in that trust fund will certainly be moved up at least a couple of years. And the hope is at that point, perhaps you have that impetus for reform. And there is historical precedent for that. You go back to the 1980s when the trust fund was having issues and Congress acted then to change the way Social Security benefits were structured to put it on a more sustainable path. But short of that, it's a big open question on what will actually move policymakers.
Yeah, so you mentioned Congressman Amash, who has left the Republican Party. I guess he is technically an independent now, Danny, and he is looking at running for president as a libertarian. And here's what I'm curious about, Danny. There is clearly no appetite for any kind of fiscal restraint on the Democratic side. The $3 trillion package that the House Democrats rolled out, that really is just kind of an election year document. It's just a wish list of what they can and won't do. In fact, the irony, as I understand, Daddy, is actually the progressive wing of the party is upset because they wanted to go even further. They wanted to completely underwrite salaries for people. So they're not talking restraint. Republicans do talk restraint, but there is really, there's no proof of it. And they have a president who's famously not interested in entitlement reform. But here's Amash, who might run as a libertarian. Do you have any sense if there's an appetite for this in the libertarian corner of the world?
I imagine ultimately, for libertarians, they want less government spending, and that's the answer is less government spending. So I would certainly expect however many libertarians exist out there to be enthusiastic about anyone talking about real restraint on federal spending.
Mm-hmm. Now, the last time we faced a situation like this, the Great Recession, Danny, Congress passed the Trouble Asset Relief Program, TARP, mm-hmm. which I believe was $700 billion.
$700 billion. Yep.
Right. And at the same time, they raised the debt ceiling. And I think they raised it to $11.3 trillion at the time. Where is the debt ceiling today, and where is the debt ceiling going to have to go to accommodate what we're doing?
So actually, at the moment, I believe, and I'm actually not quite sure, but I'm pretty sure the debt ceiling has been suspended for the next year and a half, and at which point it will just be bumped up to some higher level. And so the reality is the debt ceiling is something that, we always talk about every couple of years. Presidents are always saying we need to increase it. There's some members of Congress who think it's a way to restrain government, but the act of not lifting the debt ceiling means you're defaulting on some share of your debt, which could produce huge consequences for how people view the safety of a treasury bond. So I think, the debt ceiling is sort of a side debate. It gives people an opportunity to talk about these issues. But in the near term, it's certainly not any sort of fiscal restraint that we can count on. And we go back to TARP, $700 billion. Most of that was fortunately repaid. There was a risk being taken by the federal government when they sent that money out. But in hindsight, it turned out that the businesses that were receiving the money were able to overcome the 2008 recession. And in this case, the CARES Act, much different because so much of it includes just outright debt forgiveness. So particularly for small businesses, we're loaning money and then we're promising to forgive it as long as they meet certain conditions. So this is truly a whole different ball game than what we saw in 2007, 2008. It's on steroids and then some.
Yeah, that's an awfully good question. If you're going to give $900 billion to state and local government, is that a giveaway or is that a loan?
I think the way the Democrats are framing it, it's a giveaway, or they want to call it a giveaway, of course. Uh, But, you know, there's a real open question here on what state governments will do. And I know you have Leo Hinnian on often, and he speaks to the California issues. And we have Josh Rowell at Hoover, who's talked about the, you know, pension crisis across all states. And so, you know, it's unfortunate it's happened now, but there's no question that states for a long time have not been prioritizing their budgets in ways that make sense. So to offer them that giveaway now certainly just creates a moral hazard for subsequent bailout or for subsequent needs for bailouts as states, you know, recommit to the type of policies that got them into this the crisis in the first place.
Okay. I think we can agree on this point. Whoever's the president of the United States come January the 20th of 2021, Danny, do you see either one giving an inaugural address that talks about entitlement reform, which talks about straight? Because, again, Trump doesn't have an appetite for it. And I've got to believe, Danny, that if Joe Biden takes the oath of office, he's going to be under a lot of pressure to go just the opposite direction to keep this expansion up. So when is this conversation going to be had?
Well, you know, on the right, if Joe Biden's elected, it will people will start talking about it again in February. Right. And there won't be much credibility there, of course. But they'll start talking about it again. And, you know, you go back to, say, 2010, you know, right as we were entering the recovery from the last recession, there was bipartisan effort to actually do something about the debt. You know, you had the Bowles-Simpson Commission that certainly made an effort to propose a reform that would change the way the system, change our tax code, and also change sort of the trajectory of Social Security and Medicare. It kind of fell on deaf ears. And then a year later, the president and Congress got together and did the Budget Control Act, which was the infamous sequester that looked to cut some discretionary spending and then cut a lot of mandatory spending. And that proved too difficult. So they just cut the discretionary spending side of things. And so in a 2-year time period, we had bipartisan both sides looking at ways to constrain the debt, and that quickly went by the wayside. So you would hope that you would see a similar phenomenon in 3-4 years time from now when we're seeing a recovery. And the real question at that point becomes is what are the policies that we should have ready to go that these politicians at that point, when they do feel the urge to do something, they can dust off and commit to reform. And so in the near term, it comes down to being ready to with those reforms, whether it's finding ways to make Social Security more sustainable or Medicare, you know, the people who are concerned about this issue, that should be our focus right now.
Okay, that's a good tee up, because let's paint a world where it's a Biden presidency, but Republicans, they have a voice in Congress. Outside of the world of think tank, Danny, outside of congressmen writing white papers and writing op-eds complaining about the situation, who's actually got a plan out there right now? Who has a plan to fix Social Security or Medicaid?
Yeah, so in the case of Social Security, the right has long championed a plan that wouldn't require any Social Security cuts. This is a plan that Paul Ryan has talked about. This is a plan that people at Hoover certainly have, Chuck Blauhaus, John Kogan. You know, you go to the different think tanks and there's an agreement on sort of what this looks like. And a lot of it goes to changing the trajectory of Social Security in ways that reduce the growth in benefits. And I think we talked about this last time we chatted where, you know, Social Security right now grows at wages. So as wages rise faster, individual benefits rise faster, too. And if we just shifted the system, particularly for high income earners, to a system in which benefits only grow at the rate of inflation, initial benefits growth rate of inflation, you can solve Social Security. You can really reduce the growth in Social Security. Medicare, there's a host of plans that float out there. Most of them entail some sort of shift to more of what they call a premium support model, which would encourage people and give seniors a lump sum benefit that they can go out and buy private plans with. Some people would say it kind of looks like the ACA for seniors. But this is a plan that would give seniors more control over their healthcare and give them options to buy plans with higher deductibles, higher copays, and allow them to keep some of the difference or allow them to choose what kind of plans they have rather than being thrown into this one-size-fits-all system that we have now with Part A and Part B of Medicare.
Now, in the case of Social Security, Danny, is that what Bush 43 was proposing in his second term?
So that was a little different. So Bush 43 was including private accounts in it, and private accounts would allow people to invest a share of their payroll tax contributions into, you know, a private fund. And you know, the math is a lot harder now. When you looked in the mid 2000s, we were collecting more in payroll taxes than spending in benefits. So there was money that you could theoretically say we aren't paying to current people. We can shift over to private accounts. Now that math is no longer true. Now that math is every year our Social Security benefits, the total amount of that, exceed payroll tax contributions. So there's no money on the table for a private account system. So unless you're willing to increase deficits, or unless you're willing to subsidize the existing Social Security system in some way through general fund, you're stuck looking at more of these changing the growth rate options as opposed to private accounts.
Mm-hmm. And when you advised Jeb Bush, what were Jeb's thoughts on what to do about entitlement spending?
With Social Security, certainly he had a sort of a wage index type plan, Medicare premium support. So he was well within the mainstream right of the type of mandatory programs that that we needed to do. The harder question, Medicaid, ACA, how to change those programs in ways that, ensure people in poverty are being taken care of, but we're not creating really bad work incentives and not creating, putting people on programs that really don't work for them. That was one thing, credit to Jeb. He had a policy for just about everything. It's certainly on the mandatory side, the welfare reform, other things like that. And the big savings were going to be coming from Social Security and Medicare, though. But the other programs, certainly there are more reasons than just austerity that we need to reconsider the way we're spending on a number of these programs.
Yeah, one thing I'm interested in, Danny, is it's not just obviously addressing these huge financial problems in the budget, but it's the idea, if you will, of budget modernization. In this regard, the federal government passes a program, and it's hard to get rid of that program. It just doesn't go away. There are still vestiges of the New Deal floating around almost 90 years after it was first enacted, just as there are still government buildings in Washington built during the New Deal era. I'm thinking, for example, about the post office, which is actually tied up, I believe, in the $3 trillion package. I think the Democrats want $25 billion to prop that up. And here is a government entity that loses money every year, Danny. I think it loses like $75 or $80 billion a year on its own, and you can try to fix it in various ways. You can maybe try to do away with weekend service or something like that, but there is a question here moving forward about a federal service like the post office. Do we keep doing it, or do we try to switch to something else? And don't you think there's kind of a window here, since we're in the 21st century, to start thinking about more 21st century applications to our budget?
Yeah, there certainly are in cases like, post office and smaller line items on the budget. And I think, it's a question of what worked for today. I would say that, we certainly on the right, there's an occasion where we think of these programs and we think that this is the opportunity to really solve the budget crisis, is by getting rid of the Postal Service or by modernizing it in some ways where it's not going to be that big line item. And, when you actually add up all of those things that we would want to modernize, the reality is our budget problems are because we write big checks to a lot of people. Right. And that's less about, there's certainly good reasons to modernize. And I think, the crisis speaks to, just how both states and the federal government across the board need some, big overhauls. You look at the unemployment insurance program over the last 2 months in states where they're still relying on COBOL and Fortran to determine the size of benefits for people. And you look at California that was, doing quite well for the last few years, and they couldn't find enough money to make sure that their unemployment system worked. And certainly there are a host of examples on the federal government side that demand modernization, because we should have a government that's equipped to handle these type of crises. And right now we don't.
Right. I don't know if you saw the news yesterday, but the Biden campaign announced an entente with the Sanders campaign, and they rolled out a whole group of different areas to look at for the writing of their platform. And when it came to climate change, there was Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who is one of the chairs of that, which means she's going to push very hard for the Green New Deal. Have you looked at all the Green New Deal, Danny, and put it into any kind of budget context?
So, I have seen a number of estimates of what it would be. The American Action has done a write-up on this. I believe it was American Action who they estimated, tens of trillions of dollars of spending would be necessary to overhaul the economy in ways they're proposing. As you said earlier, just with the $3 trillion plan, a lot of this is the wish list of things they would like to see happen. And it may or may not involve environmental stewardship. It's guaranteed jobs for everyone and everything under the sun. But it's not a substantive plan to deal with, real life important issues like climate change. It's a plan to appease everyone, in their party. I think there's certainly room to talk about a carbon tax or something like that. And it's a shame that we see the left going to more of these pie in the sky type approaches as opposed to something real substantive that could attract attention even among the people on the right.
Yeah, well, here's the challenge, I think, for the right, Danny. It's the same problem Republicans ran into in 1933. Well, back then, they were just vastly outnumbered, so they had more than one problem. But when Franklin Roosevelt unveiled the New Deal, obviously was a bunch of ideas for how to restart the economy. By that rubric, it was a failure. Essentially, I was looking at the 14.7% national unemployment stat. The last time we hit that number was 1940. That was year 7 of the Roosevelt economic plan. So as an economic elixir, no, it doesn't work. But what it did provide, Danny, was a lot of psychological benefit. The idea that you're doing something, you care about people, you're just, the government's giving you a big bear hug, if you will. And I mentioned that's how Biden would sell New Deal 2.0 if he were in that position. So here we are on the right. You're talking about fiscal responsibility and saying we can't go on like this. But again, when they're toying with people's emotions, how do you push back with your with your statistics and math saying can't go down this road? Because as you know, in politics, emotions usually prevail.
Certainly. And you know, it's a really tough political question. And I worked for Jeb Bush. So, you know, clearly not the best political answers necessarily. But I think when you actually look at these issues, you know, particularly with the Green New Deal, there is so much in it that is antithetical to what most Americans want. And certainly with jobs guarantee and things like that, when you actually push people on it, they don't want the government taking an active role in these things. So there's plenty of areas like that. Now, when it comes to things like the universal basic income, that's a much harder argument to make on why that's a dangerous road to go down. And it's something where, you know, you get people on the right supportive of it. So I think it's depending on what the issue is that Biden decides to champion, it's certainly the case it's going to be hard to convince a majority of Americans that these type of ideas are in the long term really harmful to the economy and harmful to individuals as they go out and seek employment. But it's certainly a tough political case to make. And unfortunately, I don't think I have a good answer.
You have an honest answer, though, but you don't have an answer. At least that's a start. You have an honest answer. But in terms of the alarm bell going off, Danny, it's the 2020 campaign is obviously not going to be a conversation about that. It's going to be about Trump and COVID. Maybe not in that order. Maybe in that order. We'll see. But what about 2024 or 2028 or 2032? In other words, match up those political cycles, Danny, against when the tables tell us we're going to have a problem.
Yeah, so certainly 2024, both parties are going to need to be talking about Medicare just a year or so after that, depending on what the economy does to the Medicare Trust Fund. That's scheduled to go insolvent. So both sides will need some plan to address that. And then in 2030, sort of the same issue with Social Security, where the Social Security Trust Fund will be going. So those serve as sort of the historical times where Congress has chosen to act in the past. And you know, who knows if this time will be different. It might just be the case that both sides say, well, we'll just change the law and say that Social Security and Medicare and Medicare Part A can just take money straight from the rest of the general fund of the government. But that's at least a milestone that people are going there. There will have to be substantive legislation written that does something on that front. So that's the only sort of thing I can think of. Beyond that, you know, you would hope that the recovery is quick and we see unemployment drop back down to what were historic lows. And hopefully at that point there is this this realization that we've had really bad priorities when it's come to the federal budget for a long time. And we need to reprioritize. And part of that will mean changing our mandatory programs, changing entitlement programs, and then also, you know, modernizing certain parts of government that clearly failed us over the last few months.
Okay, 535 members, voting members of Congress, 435 in the House, 100 in the Senate, Danny. Can you point me to an honest-to-goodness budget samurai among that bunch? And by that, I mean not a gadfly, not somebody on the right who wants to wipe out that part of education or somebody on the left who wants to wipe out the Pentagon, but somebody of authority, somebody who's seen as an adult, somebody who the media takes seriously, somebody who would stand up and take notice if he or she came forward and said, we've got to start cutting and here's where to do it. Is there anybody in that capacity right now on the Hill, Danny?
You know, I have friends who work for different senators, so I'm hesitant to say a name without, but you know, certainly there are people who express concern. Mitt Romney has, Marco Rubio on occasion in the past has, you know, yeah, but generally, you know, I think everyone on the right is towing the line that, I mean, certainly right now, you know, speaking about austerity measures now is a fool's errand. And more than that, it would certainly look callous if a politician comes out there and says, we need to do something right now about this. But Even if you rewind the clock, rewind the calendar to, you know, 6 months ago, you don't have many people talking about it, you know, across the 535 members.
Okay. Marco's interesting. And I don't want to get into a weird Jeb Marco cross section here. here's Marco Rubio could be running for president in 2024. There are people who tell you he is already running for president in 2024. So he's a guy who's got an eye in at all times his political viability. So with that in mind, he wants to be viable. He wants to be electable. What is he talking about in terms of addressing the budget? In other words, how far to the limb has he gone so far?
Not far recently. You really have to go back to 2016 and what his campaign was really rolling out to find things that were substantive. You know, he was pitching reforms to Social Security, reforms to Medicare, reforms to the Affordable Care Act. And those things were worthwhile endeavors that largely matched other campaigns. But since then, he's largely remained quiet. He's entered more of this populist frame of, you know, thinking about ways to make the economy work better for low-skilled, you know, non-college educated Americans. And those are noble endeavors that he's doing, but he hasn't focused too much on these things, at least not what I've seen.
Okay. I'm now going to put you in a very bizarre world, Danny, where Donald Trump, of all people, wants to talk to you, and he wants you to show him America off balance, and he wants you to walk him through the budget. Ivanka's told him it's bad. Jared, somebody's gotten his ear and said, you got to start looking at this, Mr. President. So you sit down with him and you walk him through your clever little website. What are you going to point out to Trump? In other words, if you have only a few minutes of his time and his attention, what do you draw him to?
I think the biggest thing you can point out is just how much of Social Security and Medicare goes to high income individuals. And this is something that we talk about on America Off Balance. And once you realize just how much of this was John Kogan, a senior fellow at Hoover, wrote several years ago about the millionaires next door. And these were high income Social Security, Medicare recipients who had an entitlement when they turned 65 that was worth around $1 million. And when we're talking about addressing these programs, if you want to focus on something where there's a populist element to it, changing these programs in ways that reflect the fact that we can no longer afford to give very generous benefits to high-income individuals is something where I think even someone like Donald Trump, certainly the political mind of him, should be interested in.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. But again, we just don't see Trump going to this in a second term if there is a second term, right?
No, I can't imagine, short of a crisis that demands his attention. It certainly doesn't seem, particularly, you know, during the next couple of years, it would be foolish to really commit to immediate austerity measures. You know, you can begin to talk about reforms, Social Security and Medicare, and you can enact those reforms, and you can, you know, make sure everyone understands that these cuts aren't happening. There's no cut, that we're just changing the way these programs are growing. Right. But outside of that, there's very little hope in the next couple of years. So in one way, it gives me great job security to know that this problem will be with us for the future.
Yeah, but this is the frustration or the trap of the whole situation. So in an ideal world, if you want to call it that, somebody runs for president and he or she runs on doing this. And they're elected with a decided mandate and they go to office with this tailwind at their back. But A, nobody runs on this because why? Mm-hmm. They all run away as much as they can from Social Security and Medicare because you don't want to drive away old voters or seeing it be cold and heartless. So you miss that first 100 days of your office to do it. You don't do it during your first term because you're afraid about your first midterm referendum. You don't do it for your reelection. Now you're a lame duck. So you bring it out in year five or year six, as I believe 43 did. And there's just, you know, strong pushback because we're not afraid of you. You're out of office anyway in the, you know, within 4 years. So there's never a good time absent a crisis. But Danny, what would a crisis look like? Because it seems the federal government has an ability to just spend money and raise the debt ceiling and keep borrowing. So what does a crisis look like?
Yeah, I mean, a crisis could look, there could be many different looking crises. One would be skyrocketing interest rates. You know, if we discover that in future years you do see inflation and the Fed responds the way it should and interest rates rise, you will absolutely, you know, see a massive increase in federal spending that's completely beyond the control of the rest of government or of Congress. And so something like that could be an impetus for Congress responding. But at that point, you're talking about large tax increases or draconian spending cuts. And so if you'd like to avoid those, you have to do it before the crisis. But you're right. The political side of it's tough to find that. You need someone like a Ronald Reagan who entered at a time when the economy wasn't stellar and still championed these issues. And when you go through the history of, sort of any effort that we've seen to reform a big entitlement program, almost always it begins with presidential leadership. I think the only exception probably would be welfare reform in 97. So you're going to need a president to actually commit to doing something. And you're right. That probably means including it in his platform in a real substantive way.
You know, Biden would be an interesting concept, Danny, because if he is elected, we can agree that he is probably a one-term act, unless you think he's going to run for re-election at the age of 81 going on 82. So kind of like Polk back in the 1840s, here is somebody who's in a position to do something in a short period of time and then leave because he's not running again. But the reality is if he comes in, he maybe comes in with a Democratic Congress. And as you mentioned before, they're going in the opposite direction. They just want to keep spending. So I don't know. We just seem to be trapped for a moment.
Yeah, no, I would say, you know, prior to the crisis, if you had Biden enter and you had still a Republican Congress, you know, there was some early hope with Obama and the Republicans in Congress in 2010, 2011, as I mentioned earlier, to actually do something about the budget. And unfortunately, the plans that they actually implemented didn't work very well. But there was this bipartisan consensus a little bit that something needed to happen. It was short lived. So it's certainly in the realm of possibility that we could see that again. But given the fact that, you know, the recession that we're in might be hitting, you know, its nadir at or apex, I guess, depending on how you view it, you know, in around election time, it's just incredibly unlikely that either political party will be thinking about this issue for, you know, the next 2 to 3 years. So it's unfortunate. But as I've said, the pandemic is an opportunity to realize just how important it is to reprioritize. And so I would, you know, encourage people on the right and the left to think through better ways that government can operate. And that includes changing the way we budget.
Okay, so let's exit with that. Just give the listeners 3 or 4 ways in which the government should reprioritize.
Yeah, so certainly they need to begin thinking about mandatory spending that, you know, as I've said, that's on autopilot and Congress only has to deal with that in rare times. So a budget process reform that actually forces Congress to begin to think about the 2/3 of federal spending that's on autopilot is one thing that certainly is something that demands attention. Beyond that, you know, you're looking at in the near term, it's programs that what we saw in 2009, we had these massive increased unemployment insurance. We had the Affordable Care Act got put into place. And all these programs had huge, massive distortions on encouraging people to go back to work or to enter work. And so as we're thinking about those mandatory programs, we should be thinking about the behavioral effects of these and how people respond to these programs. So those would be the two things that I think when Congress is looking near term to think about, it's start focusing on mandatory programs and to focus not just on the budget side of it, but also just on how these programs affect the people who are on them.
Okay, Danny, let's end it to that point. But I'm warning you ahead of time, if there is a baseball season, if the Dodgers do win the World Series, I am sending a big blue asterisk your way, my friend.
I will gladly accept it.
Very good. You've been listening to Area 45, a Hoover Institution podcast on the policy avenues available to the 45th President of the United States. In this podcast, the budgetary avenues that Washington continues to avoid. If you've been enjoying Area 45, please don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe to us on iTunes. And if you wouldn't mind, please spread the word. Get your friends to have a listen. I'd also recommend you to sign up for Hoover's monthly Pod Blast, which gives you the best of Area 45 Econ Talk, The Class Assist, Strategica, The Pacific Century, the list goes on. We have a lot of podcasts. Hoover, we also record fellows' remarks when there is such a thing as live Hoover events. One day, hopefully, we'll have those soon. The Hoover Institution is online at www.hoover.org. While you're there, do yourself a favor and sign up for Hoover's Daily Report, which delivers the best work of Danny Heil and his Hoover colleagues to your inbox weekdays. The Hoover Institution has Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter feeds. Our Twitter handle is @HooverInst. That is @HooverInst. I mentioned Danny's work on America Off Balance. There is a website for this. It is, surprisingly enough, called AmericaOffBalance.org. That's AmericaOffBalance.org. As it tells you when you reach it, one nation under debt. My God, that's depressing, Danny. For the Hoover Institution, this is Bill Whalen. We'll be back soon with another installment of Area 45. Until then, take care. Thanks for listening.
This podcast has been a production of the Hoover Institution, where we advance ideas that define a free society. For more information about our work, and to hear more of our podcasts or see our video content, please visit hoover.org.